Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
In Massachusetts, the voting is now underway. The names on the ballot are Brown and Coakley, but they might as well be Obama and health care. The stakes are high and the rhetoric is white hot.
I know I'm not Ted Kennedy. Nobody is.
Just run a positive, healthy, upbeat, straightforward, issues-oriented campaign. And that's what I've done.
He's totally wrong. Just because you're driving a truck around Massachusetts doesn't mean you're going in the right direction.
You can criticize my record. You can talk about the positions I have. But don't ever start criticizing my truck.
Could the Democrats' agenda really all end with the election to succeed the late Ted Kennedy? Irony you can't make up on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning to you. Tuesday, January 19th. I'm Miles O'Brien in New York City for Celeste Headlee on vacation this week, joined by John Hockenberry in Washington. Good morning, John.
Good morning there, Miles. How you doing?
I'm doing
well.
Let's get right to the top stories
this morning. Just one second there. My brain lapsed. One week after the earthquake in Haiti, the numbers coming in are staggering. The European Commission now estimates there are 200,000 dead and another 1.5 million homeless. That makes the catastrophe about as deadly as that 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. 90% of the survivors in Port-au-Prince are sleeping in the streets.
We don't have no houses. Most of the houses destroyed. Even the houses stand up, people scared to sleep on them.
Thousands are now fleeing the city. Earlier, we spoke to Carol Stern, the CEO of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, about the pace of aid into the country.
It may feel slow. It is slow. We wish it were quicker, but it is more than likely as fast as it possibly could have been.
We also spoke to U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius this morning, who told us her department, HHS, is playing an important role on the ground.
HHS has one of the leads in the public health response, and also our Centers for Disease Control personnel are on the ground helping to secure and look at the safe water and food supply.
The aid is flowing in, but relief worker and Haitian singer Wyclef Jean has this reminder.
For every success story you see, there's another 40,000 that's been buried.
So far, U.S. donations for Haiti have passed $200 million.
Here at home, the story we're following closely this morning is the special Senate election in Massachusetts. It's a too-close-to-call race between Democrat Martha Coakley and Republican Scott Brown for Ted Kennedy's old seat. Joining us at a Massachusetts polling station at Cathedral High School in Boston's South End neighborhood is Jared Brown. He's a reporter for the Greater Boston. Our partner station, WGBH, carries that. Jared, good to have you with us. The polls just opened moments ago. Any sense of turnout yet?
I think it's going to be quite substantial, actually. That happens to be my same polling station. I was here for the primary for the special election, walked right in. There were barely any people here. This morning, there are already 50 people lined up just when the doors opened just now. So I think, and as I spoke to a lot of people here, they had started to take this election for granted. This is a very Democratic neighborhood, and they had taken it for granted that Martha Coakley would win. And, of course, all that changed just within the last week.
Jared, is there conventional wisdom? Does turnout favor one candidate or another?
Yeah, high turnout, I think, for this election will favor Martha Coakley because the Democratic machine is so strong in Massachusetts and there's such organization. The Republican Party is fairly weak in this state, as you can imagine. So, and Scott Brown, this is the first time he's running a major election. So it remains to be seen whether or not he has the organization to have a major voter turnout.
Thanks so much. Jared Bowen, reporter for the Greater Boston, our partner station WGBH. We'll talk more about the election in just a moment. John.
Another big story. Japan Airlines, biggest airline in Asia, filed for bankruptcy this morning. 16,000 jobs will probably disappear. Asian markets mixed. European indices down. The Dow gets underway at 10,609 this morning. Following Hurricane Katrina, people sort of famously thought that black families who were taking food were looting, but white families were just looking for food. Is there a racial dimension to the language of disaster coverage? We want to know what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry down here in Washington, D.C., here with Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. And this town, Todd, myself, Miles, we're all watching that same political drama in Massachusetts, aren't we?
Yeah, Tip O'Neill said all politics is local. Maybe not in this case. Listen to this.
We will continue the tremendous work of Ted Kennedy. I know I'm not Ted Kennedy. Nobody is. But we are certainly not sending Scott Brown down in that seat.
That's Democrat Martha Coakley. Massachusetts voters head to the polls today to vote for the senator who will fill Ted Kennedy's seat. And their vote for either Democratic candidate Martha Coakley or Republican Scott Brown could make or break the passage of Kennedy's dream, health care legislation. David Bernstein is a political reporter and columnist at the Boston Phoenix. His column is called Talking Politics. And also, as previously mentioned by John, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. David, let's begin with you. This is an awfully close race. How did this get so close, and what's the thinking today with the prospect of heavy turnout?
Well, it does look like it's going to be quite heavy turnout. The initial things I'm hearing are that people are showing up even though the weather is not expected to be too great today across the state. But it got this way because this is not as heavily Democratic a state as a lot of people assume, and the backlash against both the national Democrats and the statewide Democrats has left a lot of people in sort of a grumpy mood, if you will. And I think this has been less about specific issues than just trying to send the message about government responsiveness. And the Democrats really just didn't see it coming. They took this general election for granted and let this all sneak up on them. And as a result, the Republican, Scott Brown, has been able to define the race to his advantage.
Is that the story of this election, that Democrats took it for granted? Or is this truly a litmus test that Massachusetts voters are sort of relishing, giving the entire country?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. I think that that there's no question that Democratic voters here in the state are sending a message. And again, it has a lot to do with what's happening here in the state, which is also, you know, any problems here in the state are blamed on the Democrats who are in control of government. And at the national level, the same is true. So that's there. And the Democrats, in turn, have taken for granted their ability to win races like this and have not realized that they need to frame this election and other elections this year in those terms. They need to combat that problem in a straightforward, aggressive manner, rather than trying to respond after the Republican defines the race to that advantage.
All right. Let's bring Todd into this now. Todd Zwillick in Washington, sitting beside John there. If the Democrats lose this seat today, that makes them not filibuster-proof anymore, and that, in essence, ends health care legislation in the Senate. What's the plan B for Democrats? Is there a plan B?
Good morning, Miles. It doesn't necessarily end health care legislation in the Senate. There could be some legislative sleight of hand, and of course, as we've talked about earlier this week, it's also going to depend on if Scott Brown wins, when he's actually sworn in. They have 60 until he's sworn in, so you can digest that and digest some potential delay tactics.
But imagine the hue and cry if they tried to sneak the vote in this kind of, you know, almost like a recess appointment kind of thing.
But imagine the Democratic tragedy if health care fails. The downside of losing Barack Obama's number one agenda item is way worse than the hue and cry on Fox News.
Know. Railroading health care reform by delaying the swearing in, that could end up killing Obama in 2012.
I'm not saying it would be good, John, but having his number one agenda item fail is way worse quicker, I
what,
think.
What about the midterm elections, much less 2012? This is going to have a lot of impact there as well.
It's true. 2010 is a big deal, but in the Senate, you know, this idea of 60, it's important. And if Martha Coakley loses this race, it will be a major political defeat for Barack Obama. There's no question about it. But this idea that going from 60 to 59 debilitates Obama's agenda in the Senate is really not true. And just very quickly, look at global warming. Look at immigration. Look at a Wall Street crackdown, regulatory reform. These are all the big things the Democrats say they want to do this year. The big hard stuff, not the little stuff. You know, immigration, the big stuff. Miles, there's not 60 votes for any of these things now. Democrats are not voting in unison. The last time they tried immigration, it failed it failed to get 60. It failed by 14 votes, and the dynamics haven't changed all that much. There are moderate to conservative Democrats across the Midwest, Democrats who are not voting for a global warming bill as it is now. So going from 60 to 59, while it is a major political defeat, it's not like it debilitates Obama's agenda. His agenda in the Senate was never that strong to begin with.
David, let's talk about Massachusetts voters. I think those of us on the outside are looking at this thinking they're thinking about health care and the Obama first year. Is that really what's on their mind today?
Well, I think that that is a big piece of it. But I think that John is right in a lot of ways about the difficulties that the national Democrats face. And it's on health care and it's on other issues. But it's playing out here in Massachusetts where the folks who are on the right, center to right, it's very easy for them to be against whatever the Democrats are doing. But on the left, the base on the left is not in lockstep happy with what's happening in Washington. Many of
them... Are you talking about because of all the compromises in health care legislation?
Well, it's on both sides. You've got a lot of progressives who are exactly... That's exactly right. They're unhappy with the compromises that have been made on health care in specific, but also on some other things, slow movement on some gay rights issues, on Guantanamo Bay and so forth. But then you've also got more centrist Democrats here in the Bay State who think that Washington is too liberal. So when you're in power, it's easy to be split on your side because you're actually doing things, whereas the base on the other side are much more united in their opposition.
Todd, just briefly as we go away here, I know the president finally set the date for the State of the Union next Wednesday. I think he was hoping to have this sort of wrapped up beforehand. What's he going to say?
Well, I don't know what he's going to say, but I can tell you this. If Martha Coakley and the Democrats lose this race, they're going to rewrite that speech. It's going to be a very different message to the American people and to Congress if he's repudiated than it would have been than the speech they thought they were going to give 3 weeks ago.
All right. Safe to say that. David Bernstein, who is a reporter with the Boston Phoenix, Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks. And let's check in on stories we're following 15 minutes after the hour.
Well, in Haiti, U.S. officials on the ground are playing down reports of security problems. There have been fights among Haitians desperate to get food aid. But Rear Admiral Mike Rogers of the Joint Task Force in Haiti says security is under control.
We have seen nothing that suggests to us that we have widespread disorder, no sense of widespread panic.
Bill Clinton seconded that, saying American and U.N. troops were cooperating effectively to get aid to those who need it most.
Here's an interesting report in the Washington Post this morning. It says the Justice Department is expected to explain how the FBI illegally collected thousands of U.S. telephone records during the Bush administration. The Post says FBI proclaimed non-existent terrorism emergencies to illegally gather more than 2,000 records. Business News, the biggest airline in Asia, Japan Airlines, has filed for bankruptcy protection. It's one of the biggest corporate failures in Japanese history. Here at home, more on that NBC story. Jay Leno said he doesn't blame Conan O'Brien for his problems with the network.
Through all of this, Conan O'Brien has been a gentleman. He's a good guy. I have no animosity towards him. This is all business.
Leno will likely move back to the 11:35 Tonight Show slot.
And that's Conan says goodbye.
Yeah.
Conan says goodbye.
Yeah,
right?
But where's he going? Yeah. I don't know. they keep saying Fox, but no offer yet. So look at some of the top stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, New York Times financial correspondent Louise Story tells us what to expect from Wall Street banks after Citigroup announces its earnings later this morning. What, more bonuses? That's in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Let's start with some takeouts. And I'm down in Washington this morning, but Louise Story, finance reporter of The New York Times, is up in the studio there in New York. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning.
So bank earnings, we're going to hear some this week. Last week, J.P. Morgan had a Bank of America and J.P. Morgan had a great, great week. Citicorp's going to announce this morning. What's likely to be the result? Happy face or maybe not so much?
So we saw it with J.P. Morgan, and we expect to see with Citi and Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, Goldman, they're going this week, that trading and investment banking are raking in the profits. The good times are back in trading and investment banking. Though there are still some losses in the consumer loan books, the Wall Street part of these companies is doing really well. Now, the question is, as we get these profits, what should the banks do with them? They've paid back the bailout money with interest, but there are a lot of people down there in Washington where you are, John, who are saying they owe us more. You know, we helped them out a lot. They owe us more. And that's why we're hearing about this proposed tax from the Obama administration on the banks, because they're making big profits. They're paying out big bonuses, which get decided along with these earnings. So we're learning about these bonus levels. And so some people are saying the banks owe us more.
Will Citigroup deliver an argument to maybe put that tax on the agenda on Capitol Hill, or maybe say, actually, there are a few of these banks that are still pretty iffy?
So we've been reporting that the banks are gearing up to fight this. We had a story in the New York Times yesterday on Monday about a bank industry group that had hired a prominent lawyer to see if there's actually a legal case that they could make to fight this tax and say, look, it's not fair to retroactively impose a tax like this. And so the banks are getting ready to fight this. And, you know, given that they've paid back the bailout, there's a lot of people who think they have a strong argument that, you know, they pay back the bailout, leave them alone. So that's the fight.
There were some high-powered lawyers on my train down here to Washington yesterday.
Ready to fight.
Should the Wall Street profits be taxed more heavily than usual? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Miles?
Time now for the Sports Takeout. Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is here. The tragedy in Haiti has not escaped the sporting world. Here's Indianapolis Colts wide receiver Pierre Garçon, who has family in Haiti.
I haven't heard too much lately from family because of the communication. Phones are not back 100%. You know, it's still hard, but we're still looking for family members and, you know, still trying to be positive.
Ibrahim, Garçon, not the only athlete affected by this. How is this affecting some of these pro athletes?
I think it's there's a couple of specific athletes. One notable one is the Canadian, Montreal Canadiens intimidator, George Laroque, who is of Haitian descent. He's one of a handful of players who are of Haitian descent, and he's been looking for his family. The Montreal Canadiens pledged.
So they're missing still.
Correct. Yeah, some of them are missing as well. The Montreal Canadiens have pledged $100,000, and also they've agreed to match the fans' contributions. Just yesterday, Philadelphia 76ers center Samuel D'Alembert, he decided he was going to leave the 76ers, and he's going to go and participate in earthquake relief for Project MediShare. And they just released that statement last night through the AP. He's the NBA's only Haitian-born player, and he himself has made a $100,000 donation, and he said he will also match donations made by fans at the game that he's going to be at the home game on Friday. And then finally, there's also a boxer who had his share of troubles, because right now his Andre Berteau, he lost several family members to the earthquake in 2 days without a word. His sister and his niece were fine and they were survived, but they were left homeless. So there's a number of different athletes that are dealing with the loss and dealing with the uncertainty of the earthquake relief.
And most of these athletes are continuing playing, or are they not?
Well, Berto actually pulled out of a match that actually has shaken up the boxing world to some degree. The other athletes, Pierre Garçon, he's in the middle of a huge playoff hunt with the Indianapolis Colts. D'Alembert is going back to the 76ers. He's not going to play this week, but he's going to play Friday. And then you have the George Laroque, who's continuing to play. And actually, the day after the earthquake, he scored a goal, and he said he did it for hope for all Haitians, that hope was still there.
All right. I guess it's hard to stay focused nonetheless. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thank you very much. John.
Good morning.
Well, we continue to get responses from you from all of our coverage of the Haitian disaster, and with pictures everywhere. We got this from Jeffrey in Lansing, Michigan yesterday. He called 877-MY-TAKE to say he's surprised that teachers, with all the coverage, don't talk about Haiti in schools.
I asked my young nephew, he's about 12 years old, I imagine you've been talking about the tragedy in Haiti at school, and he said no. And I said, well, you mean not one teacher has brought up what's going on in Haiti right now? And he said, no, a couple of kids talk about it in the lunchroom, but that's about it.
Well, we were certainly talking about it earlier this week, the difficulty of talking about disasters with kids who are curious but also fearful. If they can raise money in school, selling cookies or lemonade, choosing a charity to send that money, even if it's a very small amount, it can be helpful for kids who have all kinds of questions.
And for people who find themselves with a little extra cash burning a hole in their pocket this morning, I wish, maybe Wall Street bonus, perhaps, something like that. Nancy from Sterling Heights, Michigan, has this idea.
You know what? The bankers who all are being frowned upon for their huge bonuses, I think they should donate them to Haiti and then bring home hundreds of Haitians to stay in their big houses until they can get reestablished back home in Haiti. And then everybody will think that that money was well spent. That's my solution.
Good work, Nancy. But with all that
bonus money laundering there.
Yes, with all that money being donated, the question of accountability comes up. Nick from Cliffside Park, New Jersey, says that while we should all donate as much as we can,
it has to be in the context of some kind of military or policing power that just overrides the local, quote, authorities and makes sure that none of this aid is ripped off or diverted by the rich and the powerful, because they don't really care about the poor there. They never have.
Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, since Haiti's earthquake, it's been a flood of images of destruction and human devastation. Some of those images are so-called graphic images. When does content cross the line? We're going to discuss coverage in just a moment. Right now, let's check in on some top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. It was a week ago today when the ground shook in Haiti. The European Commission now estimates there are 200,000 dead and another 1.5 million homeless. Survivors are streaming out of the capital city of Port-au-Prince now, while those who stay are facing increased desperation. You're hearing the sound of Haitian police chasing away a crowd that was breaking into a store. But Rear Admiral Mike Rogers, the director of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says aid distribution in Haiti is still possible.
We want to keep doing faster and do more, but there's nothing in the security environment right now that is significantly inhibiting our ability to execute those missions.
And that assessment is corroborated by other sources on the ground in Haiti. Right now, there are 1,700 U.S. troops there, with another 6,000 expected this week.
The big story we're following here at home is today's special Senate election in Massachusetts. Democrat Martha Coakley is running neck and neck with Republican Scott Brown for Ted Kennedy's old seat. The health care bill may hang in the balance because Democrats need that seat to avoid a filibuster in the Senate. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for us, The Takeaway, says Democrats are scrambling for a way to salvage their hard-fought health care package in case Brown wins.
Democrats have now been hatching a plan that's been confirmed to me that what they may have to do instead of negotiating a health care bill is simply have the House pass the Senate bill.
If that happens, President Obama could sign it into law without another Senate vote needed. Two big business stories this morning. Japan Airlines, the biggest airline in Asia, filed for bankruptcy this morning. And Cadbury, the British candy maker, has accepted Kraft's takeover offer worth nearly $19 billion, potentially creating the world's largest maker of chocolate and candy. Let's check the markets. Asia markets were mixed. European indices are down. Gold trading down. Futures down. The Dow gets underway at 10,609. S&P 1,136. And the Nasdaq opens at 2,287. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Think of the language of the coverage of the disaster in Haiti. Words like desperation, lawlessness, violence, charged words like looting. But what about, hey, what would you do if you were in the same situation? Listen.
What about the fact that if it's your child or your mother, what would you do? Wouldn't you go in and grab water or diapers? They say looting. They don't even describe the context. They don't even describe if a person walked out with a few things they really needed or if they just ravaged a store.
Well, you can register your comment at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org. Our listener raises an important issue. It's an issue of language and also the images that are coming out of this 24-hour news cycle. Images also on the front page of newspapers all over the United States. Listen to this. Wolf Blitzer here is talking about some video he's about to show. And it's always seemed to me that when a news anchor says, this is graphic, this is a graphic image here, that maybe they actually want you to actually see the video. Listen to this.
Earlier today, CNN's crews witnessed the looting of a store in Port-au-Prince. Young men, many of them armed, took boxes of candles, then sold them on the street. The video we're going to be showing you is very graphic. Young people perhaps shouldn't see this video.
It's from CNN, of course. Do they really not want you to see the video? And does a picture of an event where a store is being ravaged by people in Haiti, does it represent simply one image out of context? Or is it representative of what you're likely to conclude as a trend throughout the country? Here to talk about the coverage and the difficulties and pitfalls of covering a disaster like the earthquake in Haiti is Natalie Hopkinson, media and culture critic for The Root. She joins us from her home here in Washington. Good morning, Natalie.
Good morning.
And Philip Kennicott is Washington Post culture critic, also on the line from his home in D.C. Philip, good morning.
Good morning.
In general, Natalie and Philip, let's begin with how would you assess the coverage and what sort of pitfalls have we embraced or avoided in your view of what's gone on in the past week? Natalie?
Well, you know, I have to say I agree with the caller about the looting issue because it has become a very charged, value-laden description. And, you know, the sheer number of images that are coming out have an impact on viewers that, you know, we probably are only beginning to understand. And I think that in Philip's excellent essay in the Post about the media images, some of the standards that usually accompany you know, what kinds of images are allowed to be published have been loosened. And, you know, and I do wonder about what the impact of that is.
Philip, you know, I sometimes sense that the media follows a certain kind of script. In the beginning, it's what did it look like? Then it's the survivor stories. And then finally, it becomes the focus on security. And in each case, it's a distortion of what's actually going on. What's your impression?
Well, I think you're right with that. In the very beginning, I was struck by how graphic the first images coming out were. And that's not just the photographers in the field. That's a series of decisions that are made up and down the chain of a news organization. And it did seem to me as if, for some reason, with Haiti, the standards were changing for what newspapers in particular were willing to show. I think as time goes on, the coverage only gets in many ways worse and worse, especially as you see the large sort of television and cable news organizations there, because they look for very, very well-patterned narratives. They look for survival stories, and they look for social violence stories, and they tend to find them because all of that is happening.
Right.
But I trust the coverage in a way less and less the longer the larger news organizations are there.
You know, that's interesting. And you know, even the language is distorted here. I mean, Natalie Hopkinson, suddenly there's lawlessness. Well, there's no sudden lawlessness in a place like Haiti. They've been struggling with lawlessness for generations. And secondly, suddenly there's violence. Isn't an earthquake violence, Natalie?
It very much is violent. And, you know, lawlessness, I mean, the government buildings have been demolished. So, you know, there would be a little bit of a challenge with the law. There are police officers who don't even have uniforms to put on. Many of them are searching for their family, and it is very much a struggle for survival. And, you know, if you call that lawless, it really does conjure up a lot in many viewers who are used to seeing images out of the developing world. You know, it connotes that they're behaving less than honorably. And, you know, when, you know, in fact, people are just trying to survive.
Natalie Hopkinson is media and culture critic for The Root, and Philip Kennicott is Washington Post culture critic. You're both under the same media umbrella, working for essentially the same organization. How has the rapidly changing media environment, Philip Kennicott, changed the narrative for this disaster, do you think?
Well, for one, with the Internet, of course, we can really find the images we're looking for, no matter how graphic or tame they are. The other is competition.
And well, let's stop there. That's an interesting point. So people can surf for dead bodies.
Right. So I don't think that you know, the old gatekeeping function obviously has changed a lot. People will look for and find almost anything out there. So the self-censoring that the media used to practice isn't really nearly as enforced as it was.
Oh, that's a really interesting point. How do you think that affects the priorities of network organizations who bring enormous amounts of resources into a place like Haiti to cover it before we go?
Well, I sense, looking at the television footage, that they are looking for more dramatic. They are inserting their anchors into the events as participants to give it kind of more dramatic life. I think they're crossing boundaries that we haven't really seen, boundaries that were suggested by Katrina, but a really, you know, kind of a new way of approaching this is taking form now.
Fascinating, and lots to think about there. Philip Kennicott is Washington Post culture critic, and Natalie Hopkinson, media and culture critic for The Root, both talking about the coverage of the Haitian disaster. And we're going to look at the earthquake 1 week later through the lens of music in Haiti. So stay with us. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry in Washington.
And I'm Miles O'Brien in New York, in for Celeste Headlee this week. In Connecticut, a horrific triple murder of a family is turning into a test of the death penalty. Only the father of this family, Dr. William Pettit, survived. His wife and two daughters were brutally murdered in one of the most savage crimes in state history. Joining us is Colin McEnroe, Hartford Current columnist and host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Colin, good to have you with us. How has this affected people in Connecticut?
Well, I mean, it's almost as though it's the only murder that has taken place in Connecticut in the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, there are maybe about 30 murders in Hartford every year. I can pretty well guarantee you the average person doesn't know the name of any of the victims or the circumstances of the crime. People tend to know quite a bit about the Pettit murders.
All right. Now, this is factored into kind of an ongoing debate in Connecticut about the death penalty. Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, in Connecticut, we're a death penalty state. We had the first execution in 45 years in New England in 2005, the execution of Michael Ross. We have 11 men on death row right now. But on the other hand, the legislature, even kind of in the teeth of the outrage over the Pettit murders, the legislature voted last year to abolish the death penalty, and the governor vetoed that bill, citing pretty much only the Pettit case as her reason.
So is it speculation? I know, but if it weren't for this case, do you think that perhaps the death penalty might have been rescinded there?
I don't know. I'd have to be able to look into the mind of M. Jody Rell, our governor, and I've never been very successful in doing that. She might have vetoed the bill anyway, but certainly this provides a dramatic reason for vetoing a bill like that.
Dr. William Pettit, the sole survivor of this horrific attack at their home in Connecticut, what's his role in this debate?
He's become very, very public. He's, understandably interested in vengeance. He is an advocate of the death penalty. He was furious, publicly furious, at the legislature for passing abolition of the death penalty. He and his sister now lead a sort of a grassroots organization supporting the three strikes and you're out law.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because it does get into issues of parole and recidivism and letting criminals out in the street. Has that gotten a lot of talk in Connecticut?
Yes and no. I mean, at the time, in 2007, there was a call for, there were obviously huge defects in the system, and people felt that, you know, there was something terribly wrong with the criminal justice system. There was a huge outcry for an overhaul. Now, simultaneously with jury selection, we actually are scheduled to have this week, I think, one of the first reports on the, you know, sludgy bureaucratic blue ribbon task force that's supposed to be figuring all this stuff out. The truth is almost none of the reforms have been accomplished in the last 2 years, partly, of course, because of the budget crunch. Like every other state around here, Connecticut has no money to do any of the things that were so urgently needed to be done in 2007. So there was a lot of noise, but not a whole lot of action.
Colin McEnroe, Hartford Current columnist, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks for your time.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm John Hockenberry here with Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee. I'm down here in Washington, D.C. Coming up, though, we're going to listen to the diverse voices of Haiti's music. We're going to speak with rapper Marlon Malaya and religion professor Elizabeth McAllister about the diversity of that voice of music from Haiti. in the wake of the disaster and how music is actually helping people to cope with the disaster. Right now, here is a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. In Massachusetts, the polls have opened in the race for Ted Kennedy's Senate seat. The race between Republican Scott Brown and Democrat Martha Coakley is tight. The stakes are high in the past few days. Brown has been urging his constituents to head to the polls.
Make sure that you tell all your friends to get out and vote. Do not take anything for granted.
GOP members aren't the only ones campaigning hard. President Obama rolled out a last-minute TV ad supporting Coakley. A Republican win would eliminate the Democrats' 60-seat majority in the Senate and could put health care legislation at risk. You can visit our website to read analysis of the special Senate election as it unfolds from The Takeaway's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Read it at thetakeaway.org. Moving to Haiti, the World Food Program is planning a tent camp for 100,000 people who have lost their homes. They'll construct this instant city the size of Burbank, California, on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince. The European Commission estimates 1.5 million people were made homeless as a result of the earthquake.
Meanwhile, there have been some improvements in the country. The flow of planes at the airport has increased in the first days after the disaster. Only 13 flights were landing each day. But Lieutenant General Ken Keene said 180 flights landed yesterday. Finally, there's been an angry reaction from Britain's Cadbury family. That's after news the British chocolate maker has accepted a takeover bid from the American food giant Kraft. Speaking to our partner, the BBC, this morning, the great-great-granddaughter of Cadbury's founder, Felicity Loden, urged shareholders to reject the takeover.
I don't think we should give up at all. We can't sell out to a plastic cheese company. So it's a horror story.
Plastic cheese company.
Plastic cheese company. I love that.
Pish posh on that. After all night After all night negotiations, the management of Cadbury accepted an offer of around $19 billion from Kraft. A sweet deal indeed. Those are some of the
news
stories.
Some people say that Cadbury chocolate is like bad chocolate.
Really?
It's
who
like
says that?
Milk chocolate.
Who says that?
It's the milk chocolate stuff. It's sort of plastic chocolate.
Oh, well, there you go. So
there you
tit
go.
For tat.
Indeed.
All right. Those are some stories.
So listen to that music, Miles. You feel that energy?
I do.
Well, there's also poignance. The name of this tune, Rebuild the House. Listen. That's Kampa music. Kampa music. Rebati Kela, which is the name of that song, which means rebuild the house. It's a poignant song this week in Haiti. One of the many voices of music in Haiti that both reflects and aids in communicating the terrible tragedy of the people of Haiti. Here to talk about it for the next segment in this hour is Elizabeth McAllister, who's a professor of religion at Wesleyan and author of the book Rara Vodou, Power and Performance in Haiti and Its Diaspora. She joins us from Middletown, Connecticut. Do I have that right on the title of your book, Elizabeth?
Yes, thanks. Hi, everybody. And can I just say I'd like to send my condolences out to everybody who lost people in Haiti, Haitian families, and also organizations who lost people on the ground. Just terribly sorry.
And that's an enormous audience that that message goes out to. Well said. Marlon Rayo Mayaya, rapper in New York, is a second-generation Haitian. I suspect you would have some of the same message to send out as well, right, Marlon?
Definitely. As I've personally lost, you know, some relatives due to the situation back home, so I definitely say rest in peace. May their souls rest in peace and, you know, all my condolences.
How important is music in that process of condolence, in grief, in understanding the experience of Haiti right now and down through history? Elizabeth McAllister, using this latest song that we just played as an example, how important is it?
Well, it's crucial. People in the streets right now have absolutely nothing except the breath in their lungs. They've had their houses crushed, their families killed, their belongings evaporated, and they have no water, which is the really most intense and frightening thing. And what we're hearing from the streets is that what they are doing is that they are gathering together and singing. And they're singing hymns. They're singing spiritual songs. They're singing all the hymns they know, which generally are about praising God and asking for mercy. And that's the reaction, and that's not just in isolated pockets or just among churches. That seems to be the general mass reaction of the citizenry in Port-au-Prince. And apparently at dusk, is when, you know, the sort of the lights go down. I mean, the sunlight goes down. Things kind of quiet down on the streets, and then all the journalists and all my friends on the ground are tweeting or emailing, you know, we're starting to hear the singing now. So music is clearly, like, basically the only brass ring that they have to hang on to right now.
Well, you say brass ring. We're going to talk about the components of Haitian music in just a moment, but let's listen to this next cut. It's called the Tribulacion. And it describes, first of all, a different type of music and a different type of solidarity there in Port-au-Prince. Listen. Elizabeth McAllister, first of all, what are they saying in that song? And, you know, it's a very different instrumentation from the compa music that we heard at the beginning.
You know, this song, I got to tell you, isn't the one that I sent your producers. So this song, I think, from what I hear, that sounds like Jean-Daniel Beaubrun. That sounds like maybe it's a song from Boukman Experience. And they're a band influenced by, largely by voodoo music, mixed with rock, but in that particular track, they also reveal their underlying Protestant influence. That was modeled more on a Protestant hymn, believe it or not. And it's saying, you know, tribulation, tribulation, that's what we're undergoing right now.
Interesting. And, you know, you've got a mix of African rhythms, you've got French influence, a lot of European instruments in a very, very African kind of mix. Marlon Malaya, what are the tools you use to create your sound?
Well, definitely the African influence is there. I mean, the type of music that I do is hip-hop. And if you do your history on hip-hop, like me, myself, I'm an MC. And if you do the research on what an MC is, they get their vernacular or whatever you want to call it, or, you know, however they kick their stuff, through something that's originated in West Africa. You know, it's something, it was a person called the Griot. And the Griot was a person that was either a praise singer or a wandering musician or a poet. You know, these guys were considered like the repository of, you know, of oral tradition. So I'm just carrying that on, you know, on top of rhythm. You know what I mean?
And you come by it rightly. Your grandfather played in Brooklyn with Tito Puente. Your father toured in a compa band. Let's listen to this song, Sentiment, right now, and I want to hear your response to it, Marlon.
Okay.
All right, so, you know, that's an important song using elements from the past. How do you use that to get to the sort of present tense that your music is about?
Well, actually, like, particularly that part we're listening to right now, there's a little bit of funk in it, which is also comprised of hip-hop, which is also what hip-hop is comprised of. So it's all the blending of styles and the genres together that make the sound of hip-hop and also make the sound of compa. Like, compa music was also influenced by the Afro-Cuban sound. That's where you get the African drums from, the cymbals, and then you hear the claves and the keys, you know, according to, you know what I mean, the Latin music scene. So it all combines with everything we're doing, man. But this song in particular is so important because of the lyrics. What it is saying in that song, if I could maybe just, you know, cite a couple lines from it.
Go quick.
Okay, it's saying, Haiti Cherie, like the USA has its motto and its saying, it says, God bless America. Haiti Cherie means Haiti, my baby, which is basically Haiti's, motto and mantra.
That's a great takeaway. Marlon Rayo Mayaya is a rapper in New York, a second-generation Haitian, comes from a family of famous Haitian musicians, and helping us to hear through the window of Haitian music, Elizabeth McAllister is a professor of religion at Wesleyan and author of the book Rara Voodoo, Power and Performance in Haiti and Its Diaspora. Thanks to both of you, and let's go out at some Haitian music.
Thank
Miles,
you.
Listen. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Miles O'Brien. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.